what I found. Sing my thanks for what I found.
Ordinary Elephant here on KPR with Joy Has Not Forgotten Me, and before that, Midlife, their latest album simply called Ordinary Elephant, the duo of Pete DeMore and Crystal Hyrule DeMore's new one, and it is a dandy. Ordinary Elephant did a concert for us for Kansas Public Radio a while back. We were going to have them in originally in the fall of 2000, and we know what happened to that. We finally had them in, and they were great. And they're coming back to Lawrence, thanks to Rick Friedman and Lisa Harris-Friedman. They're presenting Ordinary Elephant in concert at the Vintage Church here in Lawrence, and that is happening Friday, July the 26th at 7 p.m., the Vintage Church at 1501 New Hampshire. There are tickets available through Eventbrite, E-V-E-N-T, B-R-I-T-E.com, eventbrite.com, and you're there. Search in Lawrence, Kansas, and search for Ordinary Elephant, and you'll find that, or just search for either of those, and you'll find that. Ordinary Elephant, July the 26th. Coming up on Kansas Public Radio, in about 15 minutes, we'll hear the terrific latest album from Molly Tuttle, and we've got one right now from Jillian Matunden. Her debut full-length album, Singing the Moon, came out this year, and we're going to hear a song from that right now. It's Jillian Matunden on Kansas Public Radio. That is Jillian Matundin. Worth, name of the song here on KPR, the first of 12 on her new album called Singing to the Moon. Jillian Matundin, a first-generation Filipina-American who grew up in central New York, lives in the D.C. area, works in the labor movement when she's not writing, singing, and performing songs. Jillian Matundin. Here on Kansas Public Radio, we're going to hear from that great Molly Tuttle album from last year, City of Gold, in just a few minutes. In about 8 minutes, we'll hear from Sarah Jarosz's album from last year called Polaroid Lovers. That is next. We're here, and we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, 91.5 Lawrence, 90.3 Chanute, online at kansaspublicradio.org. Sarah Jarosz's album, Polaroid Lovers. Let's hear one called Days Can Turn Around here on KPR.
So many times through the rolling hills, banners rise. Heard you run to hell and back through the raging wind. A turning track stirred the dust time after time, but you hear me.
Sarah Giroux with When the Lights Go Out, and before that, Days Can Turn Around, here on KPR, her album from early this year, called Polaroid Lovers, for you here on Kansas Public Radio. We're going to hear a recent release by the trio Low Lily, but right now it's last year's award-winning album from Molly Tuttle, songs from the album City of Gold, here on KPR.
I'm Gold Rush Kate from the Golden State with a nugget around my neck. I keep the red lights burning bright from here to hell and back. I've dug for silver and for gold from Boulder up to Haines. When I hit Coloma, boys, I made my final claim. Across the high Sierras in the spring of 48, and every man with a shovel and pan has stumbled through my gates. Behind these doors, whiskey pours and loving flows like wine. Supposed to mother loads, they'll dig or else die trying. Eldorado, woo-hoo-hoo. my boys, you never make it high. There's Redwood Bill, he can drink his fill, so can John Rover. Bad Luck Dave is in his grave, his gold dust stays rover. They fill the pails with blood and sand, call the God upstairs. But in the golden country, boys, the Lord don't hear your prayers. If you run into Reno Maria, when the sky's dark, she can read the stars from Mars to Cassiopeia. She comes around when the sun comes down with fortunes to be told. For a copper penny, she'll tell you plenty, except where to find the gold. Stay away from Snake or Jake, fool you with a fountain pen. One look in his eyes, you'll be hypnotized. He's got that sleight of hand. He's sleek and fat like an old tomcat. They say he has nine lives. Snake or Jake sure met his fate when they shot him down 10 times. Don't stake the claim with the Dogtown gang or the boys from Rough and Ready. Don't thumb your nose at the Sydney Cove, cause the hammer comes down heavy on every jack who tries to hack his way to fortune fair. He's to find his last in line to be a millionaire.
Looking for the next high time, right on the sandwalk here.
Kelly Tuttle and her band Golden Highway on KPR, the Grammy Award-winning album from last year called City of Gold. We heard El Dorado and then Son Joaquin for you here on Kansas Public Radio's Trail Mix. Our old friend from Italy, Beppe Gambetta, just sent along a new album called Terra Madre. We'll hear from that. We'll hear a song which he does with Tim O'Brien and David Grisman, among others. And up next, the trio Low Lily here on KPR. Well, today on the Moth Radio Hour, stories of time, its possibilities and its limitations, a secret room, a final basketball game, and a countdown to marriage with no suitor in sight. It's Storytelling Without a Net on the Moth Radio Hour. That is today at 5 o'clock on all KPR stations, KPR 1 stations, that is. Well, a few weeks ago, I played some music from a few years back by the band Low Lily, and I checked their website, and I saw they had an album come out the last part of last year. And so I got a hold of Flynn Cohen from the band, who I've known for many years, and said, hey, could we get this? And he sent it along with his own new solo album, which I played from last week. The album's called Angels in the Wreckage. The basic trio of Low Lily, Liz Simmons, vocals and guitar, Flynn Cohen, mostly guitar, but also mandolin, and the fiddler Natalie Padilla. But some special guests included on this number that Sean Colvin wrote, Lisa Schneckenberger helping out with the vocals, Dirk Powell, the producer, on bass, Stefan Amadon on drums. It's Round of Blues, Low Lily Style, on Kansas Public Radio.
I'm began to find out who we were all this time. When love grew bolder, all so tender like a love song. With joys and troubles, but love is long.
The band Low Lily here on KPR came out a few months ago, but new to us at KPR, the album called Angels in the Wreckage. We started off with their cover of Sean Colvin's song Round of Blues, and then a song written by Liz Simmons and Flynn Cohen of Low Lily called Where We Belong. By the way, the fiddler in the band now is Natalie Padilla, who is fantastic. It was Lisa Schneckenberger before that. She's fantastic, too. But I had played quite a bit from an album Natalie Padilla did, called Montana Wildflowers, and was really knocked out. So good to see her as part of Low Lily. I guess hear her as part of Low Lily, since it is radio after all. I'm Bob McWilliams. We've got time for one more before we reach start eight, and then all things considered at 4 o'clock. And Beppe Gambetta has sent along a new album called Terra Madre, and he brings together American and European roots in this album. And we're going to have a very American one that dates back to Beppe's exposure to bluegrass and hanging out at places like Winfield, for example. It's a song called Sit and Pick With You, written by Beppe Gambetta and featuring guest vocals by Tim O'Brien and guest mandolin by David Grisman. Beppe Gambetta, Sit and Pick With You on KPR.
Don't need too much written tone and touch. Here it comes back again, steady like an old freight train. It's so good to sit and be with you. Like you are Maybelle, it's so good to sit and pick with you. I just need to sit and pick with you.
Gambetta on KPR, his new album Terra Madre. That is Sit and Pick with Me, with the vocal by Tim O'Brien, the mandolin by David Grisman, here on KPR.
Stardate July 6th. Three tiny constellations are stacked up in the eastern evening sky this month: the Arrow, the Dolphin, and the Little Horse. There's not a single bright star among them. But under moderately dark skies, at least one of them is pretty easy to make out. The Arrow is at the top of the stack. It's the third smallest of the 88 modern constellations. In ancient times, it represented a weapon used by Hercules, but there were different takes on his target. All of its stars are faint, but under especially dark skies, it does look like an arrow, aiming toward the left. It's between two bright stars, Altair to its lower right and Deneb to the upper left. The most prominent of the three figures is the Dolphin, which is below the Arrow. Its five brightest stars outline the Dolphin's form. It too has more than one myth. One of them said the Dolphin rescued a rich poet and musician. The man had jumped into the sea after he was threatened by the crew of the ship in which he was sailing. Finally, there's the Little Horse. It's the second smallest constellation, and it's quite faint. And it's not even a complete horse. It's depicted only as a horse's head. One of its Greek stories said it was the brother or son of the winged horse Pegasus, which rises below it. If your skies are nice and dark, look for these tiny constellations beginning at nightfall and rolling across the south during the night. We have more sky watching tips, astronomy news, and much more about the universe in Stardate magazine. Details at stardate.org. For the McDonald Observatory, I'm Billy Henry.
At NPR, it's our job to be skeptical.
So tell me, why is this not already happening?
And provide context to the day's headlines.
Where does this leave U.S. efforts to try to broker a ceasefire to end the war? Where does it stand?
This is independent reporting you can trust. This is NPR.
We're here and we are Kansas, University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. I'm Bob McWilliams. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon for Trail Mix with All Safe Considered up next, followed at 5 by the Moth Radio Hour. And I'll be back with a new edition of Trail Mix tomorrow afternoon from 1 to 4. Support for Trail Mix on Kansas Public Radio comes from the law office of David J. Brown, LC in Lawrence, working to help individual small businesses, families, and non-traditional families with legal and estate planning needs, located at 120 East 9th Street in Lawrence.
I feel as long as I gave it my all and I did the goodest job as I know I can do, that's what this is about.
President Biden says he's not dropping out of the 2024 race, but the pressure continues to build. For Saturday, July 6th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido. Today on the show, what the Supreme Court's recent ruling on presidential immunity might mean for the case accusing Donald Trump of trying to overturn the results of the 2020 election.
I'd say it guts, if not completely nullifying. So there's big parts of the case that the court have made clear just go away.
Also, a NASA spaceship has had its return to Earth delayed. What is it like to be an astronaut waiting to come home?
So we were kind of stuck in space, low on supplies, and we didn't know how long. It was kind of funny. It was like COVID.
And a new podcast explores the life of Mexican pop icon Juan Gabriel after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Biden says he's staying in the race for the White House, even as more lawmakers and donors call on him to step aside. Yesterday, he sat for an interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos, where he defiantly said he won't step down, insisting that polls showing him failing are wrong. NPR's Tamara Keith has more.
President Biden was repeatedly pressed on his insistence on staying in the race and whether he might be fooling himself about his ability to win and serve another 4 years. But he was defiant. He insisted that polls showing him trailing are wrong. And he often pivoted to talk about what he has accomplished and the danger, he says, former President Trump poses. But at times, his answers were also garbled, with multiple ideas tumbling out at the same time in a way that made it difficult to fully understand his point.
NPR's Tamara Keith reporting. Newly elected British Prime Minister Keir Starmer chaired his first cabinet meeting today. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports, even though Britain's Labour Party has taken the majority for the first time in more than a decade, members of a far-right opposition party also won a handful of seats in Thursday's election.
Have a lovely day. Bye-bye. Lots of love.
That's Nigel Farage reacting to hecklers who interrupted his first news conference as an elected MP. Farage is famous for losing 7 previous elections. On his 8th, he won and will take a seat in the UK Parliament next week. Farage heads the far-right anti-immigrant Reform UK party and is a close friend of Donald Trump's. He previously served in the European Parliament, but he also lobbied for Brexit, which ended up putting him out of a job. Because of the UK's winner-takes-all system in each district, Farage's party won only 5 parliamentary seats, despite getting about 1 in 6 votes. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Tropical storm Beryl weakened as it moved over the Yucatan Peninsula yesterday, but forecasters say it's expected to regain hurricane strength before it makes a second landfall. Houston Public Media's Dominic Anthony Walsh has more.
Warmer than normal temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico are forecast to fuel the strength of Beryl before it makes landfall near Corpus Christi on Monday. The National Hurricane Center warns of damaging hurricane force winds and life-threatening storm surge along portions of the lower and middle Texas coast starting late Sunday. Tropical storm and hurricane watches are in effect for those areas, and dangerous rip currents are expected throughout the weekend on beaches across much of the Gulf of Mexico. The National Weather Service forecasts flash flooding across parts of the Texas Gulf Coast and eastern Texas starting late Sunday through the middle of next week. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in Houston.
You're listening to NPR News. Researchers in western Montana are, for the first time, monitoring pesticides in rivers and lakes. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports the program aims to protect human health and wildlife.
Rachel Mallison with the Flathead Lake Biological Station is leading a new program that will monitor for pesticides in waterways in 12 Montana counties that are part of the Columbia River Basin.
There's been no program present in the state of Montana to monitor for pesticides, so we don't even know how bad the problem is.
Pesticides have already been found in water samples taken downstream in Oregon and Washington. They pose a risk to aquatic plants, fish, and human health. Mallison says her team will also help landowners find ways to reduce pesticide use and prevent runoff into streams and rivers. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Bolton in Columbia Falls, Montana.
The federal government is helping states and cities prepare for the effects of climate change, with around $1 billion funding more than 600 projects. The money comes from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Projects include flood protection, including wetland restoration, elevating buildings in flood-prone areas, and building flood walls. Other projects include making buildings more resilient to wildfires and hurricanes, and also upgrading electrical grids to withstand more intense heat. About a third of the money comes from the bipartisan infrastructure law passed by Congress in 2021. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. A flood warning has been issued for parts of our listening area. It's 88 and mostly cloudy. Wind is from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, thunderstorms with a low in the upper 60s. Wind will be from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then, tomorrow, a few showers with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, a few showers with a low in the mid-60s. It's 88 and mostly cloudy. That's KPR weather.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido, in for Scott Detrow. Democrats have been in panic mode this week over whether President Biden has what it takes to win and serve another 4 years, all this after last month's disastrous debate. So yesterday, President Biden addressed these concerns in a high-profile TV interview that ran in full, unedited, during prime time. NPR political reporter Elena Moore joins us now to talk about how it went. Hey, Elena.
Hey.
Tell us about this interview. What stood out to you?
This interview went to the heart of Biden's biggest Achilles heel, whether he's still up for the job at 81. ABC News anchor George Stephanopoulos addressed this head on. He focused on Biden's physical and mental ability to do the job and run again. He asked whether Biden would be willing to have a cognitive test, and Biden said he didn't need it. And Biden says he's confident he's more popular than the polls make it seem. Listen to this exchange about it.
Mr. President, I've never seen a president at 36% approval get reelected.
Well, I don't believe that's my approval. That's not what our polls show.
And if you stay in and Trump is elected and everything you're warning about comes to pass, how will you feel in January?
I'll feel as long as I gave it my all and I did the goodest job as I know I can do. That's what this is about.
That response, Elena, not the kind that I think would inspire a ton of confidence in people who are already worried about his chances. What has been the reaction from Democrats to this?
Well, so it's early. I mean, we haven't seen a rush of Democratic leaders come out and praise the interview, but today we saw another Democrat call for Biden to drop out. This time it was Minnesota's Angie Craig, who's got a tough race this fall. She's one of a handful of Democrats to come out publicly so far. I was traveling with Biden yesterday in Wisconsin, and we asked him about Virginia Democratic Senator Mark Warner, who has been trying to organize a group of other Democratic senators to call for Biden to bow out of the race. And Biden dismissed it and said Warner's the only senator he knows who feels this way. But we could get more details from Capitol Hill really soon. I mean, my colleagues who cover Congress say that the top House Democrats are actually meeting about this tomorrow.
And so what are Democrats looking for at this point?
Well, I mean, Biden says the debate was just one bad night. So supporters are looking for proof of that. I mean, yesterday I watched Biden deliver a pretty fiery speech in Madison. He repeatedly rejected calls to drop out. And, you know, he said his age hasn't stopped him from delivering on a ton of policy promises. But notably, you know, that was all said with the help of a teleprompter, and people are really yearning for those unscripted moments, like the ABC interview.
So to be clear, Elena, Biden is really doubling down here. He's saying with conviction that he has no plans to drop out.
Right. And yesterday on the tarmac, actually just before we left Wisconsin, we asked Biden, you know, why not let someone younger take the country forward, giving the example of, you know, like every CEO has a succession plan, right? And Biden kind of brushed it off. He brushed that question off, you know, saying along the lines of, we do have a succession plan, but it's not needed right now. He says he thinks he's the most qualified person to defeat Trump in November. But, you know, soon we're going to start seeing more polling about the debate, and that could shape the conversation here.
I've been speaking with NPR political reporter Elena Moore. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's landmark ruling this week that presidents enjoy broad immunity from criminal prosecution stunned many in the legal world. But for former President Trump, it was a victory. The decision has all but ensured the federal election interference case against him will not go to trial before the November election. It also affects his three other pending cases, along with the New York hush money trial, where a jury already found Trump guilty of 34 felony counts. So how does Special Counsel Jack Smith move forward here? My colleague Domenico Montanaro spoke to former Deputy Assistant Attorney General Harry Littman about this. He started by asking what this decision does to Smith's two cases against Trump.
So for Smith, he's got two cases, right? The one from January 6th, I'd say it guts, if not completely nullifying. So there's big parts of the case that the court had made clear just go away. For instance, everything involving his scheming with the DOJ to send false information to Georgia saying, hey, you guys have some fraud problems in your election. That's a, you know, flat out fraud scheme. But because it falls into the category of something that's core, at least the way the court put it, talking with the DOJ, he's got a free pass. Then there are other things that the court say, you know, you'll have to see one way or another. The most likely to survive seems to be the state elector schemes, where he tries with a lot of actors to have fraudulent certificates used on January 6th. Maybe that survives. And then on Mar-a-Lago, you know, his action was after he was out of the White House, except he's claimed that when he was in the White House, he made these certificates or other national security papers, he declassified them. And it's hard to know how Jack Smith rebuts that, given what the court has said. So for Jack Smith's two cases, they're hurting, but not certainly dead. And, of course, that's only if Trump were to lose, because if he wins, he just gives the command, drop these cases, and that command will happen.
How hard is it going to be, you think, for Jack Smith to overcome the presumption of immunity in this January 6th case as he tries to make this case going forward?
That's a really good question, and one we just don't know the answer to because they gave such sketchy guidance. I think it'll be pretty easy for Trump. He can proffer reasons to say at least this ought to be presumed immune, and presumptions have weight in the criminal law, and often things are decided based on them alone. So what kind of showing Jack Smith is going to have to make to convince a court that this wouldn't intrude on the authority of a president? And is it just this action in particular or the whole class of such actions? It's a really murky part of the opinion.
So I want to read a little excerpt from Chief Justice John Roberts' opinion. And he said, because the president cannot be prosecuted for conduct within his exclusive constitutional authority, Trump is absolutely immune from prosecution for the alleged conduct involving his discussions with Justice Department officials. I think for a lot of us, that raised our eyebrows tremendously. I'm sure it did for you, too. I mean, reading this right, does this mean that the evidence of Trump pressuring the DOJ into validating his false claims that there was fraud in the election is now out?
That's exactly what it means. And it sure makes me puzzled as much as you. What does it mean for Smith's case? That part of Smith's case that has to do with conversations with DOJ, even though they seem completely beyond the pale, like they're just gone. They just vaporize. And the Chief Justice, in his opinion, said it flat out because it involves those conversations as wicked and as criminal and as far from what you think a president should be doing as you can conceptualize them. They are all off the table. It's just as if they never happened for purposes of trying to prove a crime.
Let's talk about just very briefly a couple of the other cases and the potential domino effect from this case. You know, Trump was originally supposed to be sentenced for his guilty verdict in the hush money trial in New York next week on the 11th. That's been now delayed to September 18th, which happens to be a week after the potential final presidential debate. Is there a reality in which the conviction gets thrown out because of immunity at all, as the Trump campaign and Trump himself, Trump legal team, is trying to push for in New York?
So the upshot of this opinion is there's always a reality. I don't think it should happen. What could be more unofficial conduct than before you are president having a scheme to pay off someone so they don't reveal a sexual tryst that could influence the American people? But some of the conduct takes place in the White House. The real challenge here is with this point about motive, because the court says not only that you can't consider motive, but you can't even offer as evidence something that could be an official act. And what happened in this case is that some of the evidence, I was there for it, was testimony of Hope Hicks when she was his communications director, were certain tweets. And can Trump argue that those were important and official and they shouldn't have come in? And then one more step he'd have to take, which is to say it mattered. It wasn't harmless error. To me, I don't think that Justice Merchan will credit those arguments enough to say there should be a new trial, which is all that there could be, a new trial. They wouldn't throw out the case. But could a higher court, up to and including the Supreme Court, say, you know, that evidence was pretty powerful and it was of official acts and we now know from the Trump case it shouldn't have come in? Yeah, that could happen. We really are in a whole new world where kind of anything could happen in any case.
Whole new world indeed. Harry Lipman, thank you so much for being with us. Always appreciate your time.
Thanks, Domenico.
You can hear more of that conversation and get the latest on all of Trump's legal cases by listening to Trump's Trials from NPR News. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Saturday afternoon. Support for All Things Considered comes from Green Lady Lounge, offering live Kansas City jazz 365 days a year till 3 a.m. Green Lady Lounge is located at 1809 Grand Boulevard, Kansas City. Information at greenladylounge.com. And Cromwell Solar. Since 1982, installing independent energy systems such as backup batteries and solar panels for farms, homes, and businesses. More information is at cromwellsolar.com. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, a slight chance of showers overnight, partly cloudy, a low of 67. 60% chance of showers and thunderstorms for Sunday, a high of 82. Showers and thunderstorms likely Sunday night. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Biden is defending his mental health and says he's staying in the race. Lawmaker Representative Angie Craig joined other Democrats and some donors in calling on Biden to leave the presidential race over his poor performance in the debate. In the United Kingdom, new Prime Minister Keir Starmer chaired his first cabinet meeting today. He now gets to work assembling his government and tackling domestic problems. And South Texas is bracing for Beryl, the once powerful Category 5 hurricane that's been downgraded to a tropical storm. Forecasters say it could become a hurricane again when it makes landfall. Watches and warnings are up along the coast. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. From the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at publicwelfare.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido. French voters head to the polls on Sunday for the second round of legislative elections, which is likely to see the far right win a parliamentary majority for the first time since the Second World War. The National Rally Party has spent years rebranding its image, a rebrand that has attracted an increasing number of young voters, as Rebecca Rossman reports from Paris.
Merci, madame. Bonjour, madame. Pour les élections dimanche.
Just a few weeks ago, 28-year-old Julien Limongi was in between jobs and contemplating his summer vacation plans. But then French President Emmanuel Macron shocked even his closest aides by announcing snap legislative elections.
Bonjour, monsieur, pour les élections dimanche.
And overnight, Limongi found himself campaigning as a leading candidate for the far-right national rally in Seine-et-Marne, a district located about an hour and a half east of Paris. On this particular afternoon, he's handing out election flyers outside a train station, hoping to attract new voters, including the young. According to one French polling institute, about a quarter of 18 to 24-year-olds voted for the far-right party in the first round of these elections. And while the majority of young people still align themselves with left-leaning parties, the National Rally has made incredible gains with this demographic. We sit down over a lunch of steak frites and white wine, and I ask Limongi why the National Rally Party is attracting an increasing number of young people.
We are like the party of the people.
He claims the National Rally has cast off its image of being an anti-Semitic and xenophobic party to become one that is open to all. But that's an image that's hard to shake. Only days before we speak, another National Rally candidate was forced to step down after an old photo of her wearing a Nazi cap emblazoned with a swastika resurfaced online. But Limongi casts incidents like this as a one-off. He believes young people are attracted to them because they're worried about crime, immigration, and lack of spending power, topics he believes the mainstream parties have ignored for too long.
National Rally won the war of the ideas now. We know about, like, sovereignty, about the necessity to produce in France. It was not obvious 10 years ago.
The party has also been wildly successful with its outreach on social media. Take the TikTok page of the party's 28-year-old president, Jordan Bardella.
7 jours,
nous sépare désormais d'un choix historique.
He could become France's youngest prime minister if his party manages to gain an absolute majority of the parliamentary seats on Sunday. The clean-shaven younger millennial regularly uses the platform to speak directly to his nearly 2 million followers. At this rally in the southern French city of Perpignan, talk of Bardella dominates. In attendance is Pierre Thionnet, one of the members of the National Rally's youth wing. He calls the rise in young support the Bardella effect. In some places, up to 60% of National Rally supporters are under 30 years old, he says, adding that the party has grown exponentially since 2022, in large thanks to Bardella. People see themselves in his message and they want to join, he says. Back at the bistro, I turn my microphone to Julien Lemongey's 25-year-old campaign finance manager, Joël Nifson. He tells me he grew up in a household that supported Les Républicains, the mainstream right party in France. But the National Rally is offering his generation something he says the traditional parties have failed at, change.
I think that today the traditional parties don't want to change anything. They want to keep the same system, and there is absolutely no political will to change anything, to improve the life of the majority of people.
Whether it's from the far left or the far right, people across France are ready for something different, Misson says, and it's likely France will get that change on Sunday. For NPR News, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Seine-et-Marne, France.
His name was Juan Gabriel. He was one of Mexico's biggest stars, a prolific singer and songwriter, a Latin pop icon who racked up millions of record sales, wrote more than 1,500 songs, and charted dozens of hits. On stage, he wore dark eyeliner, bright, bedazzled clothes, and his voice, it kept audiences hanging on every note. Pero desgraciadamente, era una noche como esta. Cuando te encontré. By the time he died in 2016, Gabriel, affectionately known as Juanga, was a towering success. But his beginnings in Ciudad Juárez were nothing short of traumatic. He's the subject of a new podcast from Futuro Media called My Divo, a nod to another of his nicknames, the Divo of Juárez. Maria Garcia is the host of the show, and she joins me now. Maria, welcome.
Hi, Adrian. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. You know, for Latinos, Juan Gabriel was as big a celebrity as they come. Impossible not to know him. But for our listeners who haven't heard of him, describe him for me.
Oh, my God. Well, the way I describe Juanga to some of my American friends who perhaps didn't grow up listening to him is when he was young, imagine a figure just as subversive and prolific and innovative as Prince. When he was sort of an older, established icon, imagine an even more subversive Elton John. You know, picture sort of that archetype. And he wasn't just, you know, huge in Mexico. He was perhaps Latin America's most prolific songwriter and performer. And U.S. Latinos also grew up with him. And for me, he was in the air. As you mentioned in the intro, he was raised in Ciudad Juárez, where my family is from, where I was born. He's El Divo de Juárez. And so he was just sort of in the DNA of my community.
You focus a lot of your reporting on Juan Gabriel's really traumatic childhood in Ciudad Juárez, and later his struggles as a teenager as he tried to make it as a singer in Mexico City. Why did you go all the way back to the beginning?
Well, because I wanted to do something really thorough, and I wanted the reporting to be rigorous and precise, and we found really important new details that frankly changed the way we think about his story. We found just a really sort of traumatic moment that he faced in Ciudad Juárez that inevitably made me think about
the traumas in my own family history. And so I thought a lot about lineage and what's passed down to us as I was reporting this story. So we braid the story of Juan Gabriel with my own sort of like family lineage. And yes, definitely, like, there is some trauma in it, but there's also so much joy. Mm-hmm. You know, the queer exuberance that you see on stage and the way he liberated himself. And so that duality is there throughout the podcast.
Let's talk about that aspect of him, his flamboyance. It made him this remarkable figure in Mexican culture and society, which has always harbored a lot of homophobia and enforces, you know, these very rigid views about how a man should act. And Juanga defied all of that. He was very open with his flamboyance on stage. And at the same time, he never publicly answered the question that so many people sort of assumed the answer to, which is whether he was, in fact, gay. You talk in your podcast about an interview he gave when the interviewer asked him point blank.
Dicen que es gay. Juan Gabriel is gay.
Some people say you're gay. Is Juan Gabriel gay?
¿Te le interesa mucho?
You seem very interested, Juanga replied with a coy smile. And that's when Juanga delivered the now famous response.
Dicen que lo que se ve no se pregunta, mijo.
Some people say what can be seen shouldn't be asked, son.
Why did you find this answer so fascinating?
Yeah, you know, it would have been so easy for Juanga to say, no, I'm not gay. And in fact, that was sort of the status quo for a lot of queer artists at this time in Mexico. It was incredibly difficult and could be hazardous both to your career and for you as a person to be openly gay in this era in Latin America. And it would have been easy for him to flat out deny it, but he doesn't. He doesn't. He chooses to answer on his terms. And I love it because he's not saying no, but he also refuses to be a spectacle. He refuses to come out for the sake of satiating the curiosity of other people. And look, I spoke to people who were in his inner circle, and even in his inner circle, Adrian, there are lifelong friends who say, oh my God, obviously that's not even a question. Of course he was gay. He was so explicit about that with me. And other people who considered themselves close friends of his who say, oh my God, he was not gay. Alberto, the real person, was not gay. Maybe the stage persona, Juan Gabriel, was gay, but the real person was not gay. And I think it's because Juanga believed that maybe not everybody deserves to see your full self. And, you know, he had to protect himself, and he walked this world in a very nuanced way.
As much as this podcast is about Juan Gabriel and his queerness, it's also about your own experience as a queer person from Mexico. And there is a lot of personal revelation in this podcast. Did you know at the outset how much you and your family would become a part of this project?
Yes and no. The thing is, you know, I believe that you can't tell a story from a place of nowhere. You know, you tell a story from the place in the world that you occupy and the lens and the blind spots and the expertise that gives you. I'm not sort of like a dry narrator here. Like, I love Juan Gabriel. I'm a hardcore fan, you know? And when I think of Juanga, he's not only a hometown hero for me, but I think of my roots. I think of my family. Like, he's the soundtrack to my community. And so, one, I had to be honest about that. But I also had to be honest about what was bringing me to him right now. Like, why Juanga at this moment? And for me, it really was because I was thinking a lot about intergenerational connectedness, thinking about passing on my roots to my son, while at the same time, like, letting who I am authentically right now bloom, right? I'm in this beautiful queer relationship. I want to get married, and I know I will likely be the first queer marriage in my family. And so what does it look like to be, to pave that path in my Mexican family while holding on to everything that is dear to me from the path and the people who came before me. And to me, Juan Gabriel and his legacy held a big lesson for me in how to do that.
You grew up with Juan Gabriel's music, going to clubs in Juarez and singing his songs at the top of your lungs. I'm curious if all your reporting for this series has changed your relationship to his music.
I mean, it's strengthened it. Like, you know, this weekend, for example, I'm going to Ciudad Juarez. I'm meeting a bunch of my friends there, and we're going to go dancing, and we know they're going to play some Juanga songs, and then we're going to go to our favorite karaoke place, and we're going to sing Juanga songs. Every family party we have, we karaoke and Juanga comes out. Like, I love him just as much as I did, if not even more than when I started this podcast.
Maria Garcia is the host of My Divo, an Apple original podcast produced by Futuro Studios. It's available wherever you get your podcasts and is also available in Spanish as Mi Divo. Maria, thanks.
Thank you so much, Adrian.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. You can connect with NPR and your favorite member station, wherever you are. Get the NPR app for your mobile device. You can also lean back and enjoy NPR.org, optimized for the iPad. This is NPR.
A recent MarketWatch survey found that couples with joint bank accounts are more likely to be satisfied in their relationships than those with separate accounts or a mix of the two. But does that mean you have to put all your money in one pot? And how do you set yourself up for success? LifeKit's Andy Tagle has answers.
If you're married or in a serious relationship, you might be weighing the merits of combining your finances with your partner.
For some couples, having a fully joint account feels great because they are able to spend and save and talk about it very openly.
That's Lindsay Brian Podman, a Michigan-based financial therapist and author of The Financial Anxiety Solution.
For other couples, having that joint account only feels like they are losing out on that autonomy or on that independence. And so having a theirs, mine, and ours account helps to scratch that itch.
The theirs, mine, and ours approach is just what it sounds like. Couples have a joint account for shared expenses and individual accounts for personal expenses. So you're making sure your bills are paid on time. Maybe you're saving towards future goals together.
But you each have a little bit of money that you can spend how you want without having to text your partner and say, hey, can I buy a new pair of shoes? Or can I buy some Skittles when I go put gas in the tank?
In this scenario, couples might put all their money into that one joint account and then agree to a certain percentage or spending limit to claim as their own on a monthly basis. Brian Podvin says this approach is best for anyone who might have hangups around the lack of privacy from a fully merged bank account.
That can provide some of that psychological safety. It can also provide each person with a bit of autonomy to say, I'm going to spend the money that's in my account the way that I want to spend it, or I'm going to save it up forever and ever and you can't tell me otherwise. Right? None of us want to feel like we are under the control of our partner, so having some financial autonomy is really important.
Some couples may prefer to opt for fully separate accounts. Brian Podvin says that might be an option that makes sense in some cases. If you've experienced financial abuse or had your identity stolen in the past, for example, if you're going through any legal proceedings, that might make it tricky to mix assets with your partner. But the hazard of this approach, she says, are the little financial secrets that can sometimes add up when you keep your money separate.
We can have somebody who is racking up a ton of credit card debt or who is taking out personal loans or who maybe has a really not great credit score and isn't working on improving it. And rather than their partner being in on it from the beginning, it becomes a much bigger issue than it would have been if you had, say, seen your partner miss a credit card bill the very first time it happened, rather than decades later.
So the key here, says Brian Podvin, no matter which approach you choose, is financial transparency. That means not just sharing baseline figures with your partner, how much the other earns, how much debt you have, but really taking the time to understand your partner's relationship to their finances, their money story.
How does the way that you grow up shape what you think and feel about money? What do you believe you're allowed to spend money on? What are you proud of that you do financially? What are things that you wish you were a little better at financially, and how can I help support you?
Once you each have the full picture and settle on shared financial goals, try on different strategies to see how they fit your lifestyle.
So maybe we experiment for 3 months with having all of our money together and seeing what it feels like to, say, have all of our bills on auto pay. If that feels really stressful for one of us, then we have to sit down and decide, is there something else that we can do to make this feel less stressful?
Give yourself room to change and grow, she says. Managing your finances as an independent adult can be a tricky business.
It's totally fine and normal to have growing pains along the way.
For NPR's Life Kit, I'm Andy Tagle.
For more tips from Life Kit, go to npr.org/lifekit. You're listening to All Things Considered.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining here on a Saturday afternoon. Today on the Moth Radio Hour, stories of time, its possibilities and its limitations, a secret room, a final basketball game, and a countdown to a marriage with no suitor in sight. It's Storytelling Without a Net on the Moth Radio Hour. That's today at 5 o'clock here on KPR. If you're listening over on KPR2, it'll be the BBC World Service. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, a slight chance of showers overnight, partly cloudy, a low of 67. A 60% chance of showers and thunderstorms for Sunday, a high of 82, 60% chance of showers Sunday night, with a low in the mid-60s. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The Kansas Supreme Court has struck down two laws restricting abortion. The laws banned a common second trimester abortion method and imposed extra regulations on doctors that provide abortions that exceed those imposed on other doctors. Both had been blocked by lower courts. The state Supreme Court said both of those laws violated the Kansas Constitution. In northern Kentucky, 4 people were killed, 3 others wounded in an early morning shooting during a birthday party in Florence, not far from Cincinnati. Police say the gunman later died after killing himself during a police chase. And 100 life-size sculptures of Indian elephants are starting a journey across the U.S. this holiday weekend. The goal of the traveling art exhibit is to spread awareness about conservation efforts. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. From the Lummelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at publicwelfare.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido. In Nashville, more people work in the music industry per capita than any other city in the world. And member station WNXP has started a podcast called Music Citizens about those people and the jobs that they do. The first episode, called The Lifer, is about an 80-year-old man who owns and operates a small music venue called The End.
For someone who has never been to The End, how would you describe The End?
Tiny little rectangle stage.
It's like a milk carton on the floor vibe.
Just like an old school music venue.
Classy dive bar.
What's classy about it?
Just...
The bathrooms are bad, the stage is small and close.
We don't have private bathrooms for the artists. We don't have parking, right? That's the biggest thing. Everyone wants to know where they park their freaking trailers and trucks, and we don't have it.
Can you give me a, first name, last name?
First name, last name. I can give you all three names. Jason Moon Wilkins. I'm the host of Music Citizens. It's a new series from Nashville Public Radio about music's working class.
And I'm Justin Barney, producer, reporter.
We're doing this series at a time when venues like The End are in trouble. You've got gentrification, rising rents, corporatization impacting booking, all of it. It's so much so that in the UK, there's a wave of support for saving some of those venues. And in Tennessee, a bill just this year that would pave the way for helping those venues with leases just passed. And I think we're seeing this because even at the highest levels of government, people understand even the biggest artists need a place to start. And The End is a place like that.
Could you read some of the names on the wall?
Read some of the names?
Yeah.
On the wall back here?
Yeah.
What we got here? White Stripes.
I had never heard of the White Stripes when they played here, to tell you the truth. It was on a Monday night, and we took a chance on it and wound up selling out.
Paramore played their first show, Nashville at The End. Bruce and Haley have lots of pictures together.
The Flaming Lips?
Yeah, I think that's probably 20 years ago.
They played here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of bands play here when they first get started, you know. So.
It's a launching pad. And as we discovered, the one constant was Bruce.
Gotta get that right there.
I spent a couple days at The End. A thing that just blew me away was that this whole place, The End, with the names on the walls and all of its lore, is precariously held together by one 80-year-old man who does the job of 10 people.
What does Bruce do every day?
Come here. Without fail. He shows up every day.
What I do?
Yeah.
Bartend, book the bands, clean the place up.
Restocks the whole bar, orders all the beer orders, changes all the garbage bags, puts the garbage in the dumpster. He does everything.
What are you doing now?
Sweeping the bathroom floor.
Like, at one point, there's a marquee, and he pulls this rickety ladder out of the yard, and he sets it up on the marquee, and this 80-year-old man gets up on this tiny ladder, and he puts up the new band on the marquee.
There you go. You get all these empty beer bottles, beer cans, and crap.
It's a long day. You're there from 10, 9 a.m. until 1, 2, 3 a.m.
That is Allison Estes. She is the talent buyer at Exit Inn across the street. She also kind of has a job at The End.
Not a salaried employee or anything like that. It's understood that I'm going to help him do X, Y, Z and more if needed.
Why do you do it?
Because I love him and I love The End.
What are you doing now?
Checking the beer cooler, see if how much beer I need to put in there at some point. Pretty much all the money comes from beer sales.
There have been so many small independent venues like The End that have opened and closed in the span that Bruce has been grinding away at The End.
I'm Amy D. from D's Country Cocktail Lounge.
Why do it?
Because I'm a lifer. I've been in this business since 97. I didn't go to college. I don't have a trust fund to look forward to. What else am I going to do? And then you see others fade and you're still here.
And Bruce, fellow lifer, is just holding it together every night. Bruce, just before bands are starting now, what are you doing in this time?
Waiting for people to show up.
Hi, how are you? Can I just see your ID?
Yeah,
thank
I got
you.
Your ID.
Perfect. I'll see him the top of your hand.
I like that he's the bartender, too.
Right?
It's awesome. Sure. It's awesome.
Hey, could I get a Michelob Ultra, please?
Yeah, we do have a $10 minimum.
So Justin has been taking you through Bruce's day. behind the scenes, all the nitty gritty, but a big part of every day at the end is the show.
Hey, everybody. We're a guy called Lee Rose Ryan from Minnesota.
So here we are on stage. Daniel Pujol knows what it's like to stand on this stage.
Tiny little green room. The ceilings are just high enough to where everybody can crowd surf.
Lots of broken noses. We keep a lot of ice packs in the back and hardcore knives. We usually give out half a dozen ice packs.
It's just big enough is that when it's totally full, it is right before an audience becomes a crowd.
Bruce is able to do things economically at a smaller venue like the End that you can't do in a larger venue.
You can play to 50 people at the End. You know, you can sell out the End and then move to Exit on the Rock Block, right? And then you can play Marathon and then you can play Ryman. And like, there's a lot of great stepping stones in this town.
And the End is?
It's first step.
That happens every night, you know? And that's not something that's guaranteed in every city.
Absolutely not. I mean, some of these things are going to go away, and they have nothing to do with the powers that be not standing up for it. We live and work in an economy where if you own this space, and all of a sudden it's worth $5 million and it used to be worth $500,000, you're probably going to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
There is something that Bruce and the End represent within Nashville that we have seen change at an accelerating pace in the last 10 years especially, which is beloved institutions going by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
When your city is known as Music City, and when those institutions start changing, it does change the fabric for who you are. And what is being currently built right now, the vast majority of money that is being invested in Nashville on the music side is to lure tourists, not locals. And that is the fear of what you might lose if you lose a place like this.
Bruce, how do we do tonight?
Don't know. I don't know how many we'll end up paying. Do you have that figure?
38 at the door. And then I think pre-sale is 170 something. So
plus 38, what is that, 211?
Yeah.
Yeah, 211.
Is that a good night?
Yeah.
It's more than should be in here.
Yeah. Should be.
You know, he's just here to run his venue, have a good time, and to go home.
So, like, why do you think he does it?
I think he likes being a part of the story. You know, having a small role in someone's success.
It's now 12:16 a.m.
All right, that's it. Everything locked up. Time to go home. We're good to go.
You want to be an owner? This is what it is. This is the job.
This is the job.
Last words? Do it again tomorrow.
All right. See you, Bruce.
All right. I'll see you later.
Jason Moon Wilkins and Justin Barney host Music Citizens, a new podcast from WNXP in Nashville. You can listen at WNXP.org or wherever you get your podcasts. In early June, NASA launched its Starliner spacecraft into space. It was a test run for the new Boeing spaceship. The plan was to have it dock on the International Space Station and return home to Earth after about a week. Well, it's been more than a month, and the ship is still up there. A series of malfunctions have indefinitely postponed Starliner's return. For more on this and to learn what it means for the two astronauts on board, we called up Terry Virts. He's a retired Air Force colonel and NASA astronaut. He also served as a commander of the International Space Station. Colonel Virts, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
What was your reaction when you heard that the Starliner would have to stay in space longer than originally planned?
Well, my first reaction was it's probably good news for the two Boeing astronauts. They're, they get a few bonus weeks in space, and you never know when your next space flight's going to happen. I'm sure the astronauts are happy to get some bonus time in space. Also, the space station crew, that's the seven astronauts that are there, I'm sure they're happy to have some, you know, free labor for a few extra weeks. So the astronauts themselves are all happy, I'm sure.
But what's the problem up there? I mean, why hasn't this ship been able to come back?
Well, this is a test flight. So Boeing, this is the one human astronaut test flight. And then after this, it's going to be operational. So they need to make sure they're certified. Certification is the big word in the NASA ecosystem. And they had a problem while they were docking. Some of the small rocket motors that control the spacecraft didn't work. They got kicked out. And some of the helium, which is a gas that we use to make the propulsion, it pressurizes the propellant. There was some small helium leaks. So they closed off the helium. The helium's not leaking anymore. I think they're really trying to focus on what caused the small rocket engines to fire. Because it's a test flight and this is a certification mission, they really want to take the time and understand what happened.
Well, NASA and Boeing officials are pretty adamant that the two astronauts who flew the ship up there, Butch Wilmore and Suni Williams, that they aren't stuck. Is that technically right? Do you agree that they're not stuck up there?
That's true. In fact, they've actually declared that if there were an emergency, they could jump in the capsule, close the hatch, and come back to Earth. But again, this is a test flight, and the real goal, what Boeing wants and what NASA wants, is to declare this thing certified. They want to take the big bureaucratic rubber stamp and stamp certified on the Starliner, and so in order to do that, they basically have some free time. There's a few weeks that they can just stay and the engineers can analyze all the data to understand what's going on with the helium and the jets. Once they come back to Earth, they'll never be able to get that data again.
In 2015, you were in space for what was supposed to be 169 days, but NASA delayed your return after a Russian rocket blew up that was very similar to the one that was going to be used to take your replacement crew up to the space station. You ended up being up there for another month or so. Talk to us a little bit about what was going through your mind when you heard that news, that you'd be staying up there longer than you'd planned. Were you sort of in this limbo state?
Yeah, it was a little bit different because it was a half a year mission. It wasn't just a 1 or 2 week mission. And we were ready to come back. And, when they had this accident, the first thought was, well, we just lost some supplies because there had been another American cargo ship had blown up a few months earlier. So we were kind of running low on supplies. And then our next thought was, I don't think they're going to launch our replacement crew because they launched basically on the same Soyuz rocket. So we were kind of stuck in space, low on supplies, and we didn't know how long. It was kind of funny. It was like COVID. Uh-huh. Before there was COVID, it was COVID in space. But minus the virus, we were just stuck at low on supplies and didn't know how long.
How long do you think they might be up there? I mean, how long might it take NASA to figure this out and say, okay, we're ready to bring you back?
Well, I think they'll be there probably for a few more weeks. It might be longer than that. I don't know exactly what technical data they need to get, what technical data they want to get. You know, I think they've gotten what they need. They could come back tomorrow and be safe. But what Boeing doesn't want, I'm sure, is to have to fly another test mission. So they'll probably stay there as long as they need to get certified.
I just wonder whether these astronauts took enough change of clothes, you know?
I was wondering the same thing. So the one thing you don't have to worry about, the space station has more than enough supplies. I don't know the exact number, but there's like a year's worth of food and oxygen and water. And so there's plenty of supplies like that to know if they actually took enough underwear and they need some shoes to work out. I'm sure they either did as a contingency plan or they can borrow their crewmate stuff. And so I don't think that's a problem.
What advice would you have for those astronauts?
I would just say enjoy it. You know, during it ended up being a month. I took a lot of photos. I was working on an IMAX movie called A Beautiful Planet. So I helped shoot a lot of that film actually during my bonus month and stay busy. You don't want to, just sit around, but I know these two, they're not going to sit around, and I'm sure NASA will have plenty of work for them to do. The honey-do list is always long and unfilled on space stations, so there's plenty of work for them to do.
Is there something in particular you're going to be paying attention to as they eventually make their way back, whenever that is?
Yeah, the biggest question is, will they be able to certify? I mean, this is by far the big question. Because Boeing wants it to be certified so they can start launching, normal missions with four astronauts on board instead of two. NASA normally, on a first flight, you only fly two astronauts just because it's safe and you don't want to risk more lives than you have to. But Boeing's going to want this thing certified. If you haven't been reading the news the last few years, there's been some bad headlines for Boeing, so they really want a success.
Well, I've been speaking with Colonel Terry Virts. He's a retired NASA astronaut. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at publicwelfare.org. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3, K210CR in Atchison, 89.9, and K258BT in Manhattan, 99.5. And we're always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us on a Saturday afternoon. Drop in at Kansas City's Green Lady Lounge any late night and you're apt to see the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. They're in the spotlight on this weekend's Live at Green Lady Lounge. Join us for an hour of original Kansas City jazz. Live at Green Lady Lounge is this evening at 6 o'clock here on Kansas Public Radio. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, a slight chance of showers overnight, partly cloudy, a low of 67. 60% chance of showers and thunderstorms for Sunday, partly sunny and a high of 82. And a 60% chance of showers and thunderstorms for Saturday night with lows in the mid-60s. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
And the stakes with these cards were so high. Because every time I got a question wrong, it was devastating, right? Like it was somehow proof that I wasn't a genius after all. But when I got a question right, it was the best feeling in the world because I could see the pride in my dad's face. And all I wanted to do was chase that feeling of him seeing me and seeing what I could do.
Next up, the Moth Radio Hour. I'm your host, Jody Powell. In this hour, stories around time, including a love story in its final days.
So, as a grand gesture on her birthday with very limited funds, I decided I was going to take Grace to Carnegie Hall. Classic New York Humphrey Bogart Grace Kelly kind of night. I got the suit, I got the haircut, I found a concerto on her birthday.
That story and more coming up next on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX right after this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Another Democratic member of Congress is calling on President Biden to withdraw his re-election bid. Clay Masters from Minnesota Public Radio has more.
U.S. Representative Angie Craig says she did not come to the decision lightly, but there is, quote, simply too much at stake to risk a second Donald Trump presidency. She says she has great respect for President Biden's decades of service, but calls on her party to put forward an open and transparent democratic process to select a new nominee. This week, she told NPR News that her constituents don't like their options on the presidential ballot this year, but stopped short of calling on him to drop out following his debate performance. Craig is in a competitive House district in Minnesota. Craig joins a small but growing group of U.S. House members who've called on Biden to step down as the nominee. Biden said he would not do that several times Friday night during an interview on ABC. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in St. Paul.
The federal judge today postponed some deadlines in former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago classified documents case, allowing prosecutors more time to process Trump's request for a longer pause in the wake of the Supreme Court's ruling on presidential immunity. Judge Aileen Cannon says special counsel Jack Smith has until July 18th to respond to Trump's request for a broad delay. The judge hasn't yet set a date, though, for Trump and his two co-defendants to go to trial. Trump has pleaded not guilty to all charges. More than 100,000 homes in Ukraine are without power and water after a series of airstrikes carried out by Russian forces. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports Russia also stepped up attacks on the east, killing at least 11 people and injuring dozens more.
The northern region of Sumy borders Russia and is often the target of Russian shelling. On Friday night, Russian strikes hit energy infrastructure in the region, cutting off power to tens of thousands of households. The regional capital, where more than 250,000 people lived before the full-scale invasion, also lost access to running water after Russian drone attacks. In the eastern Donetsk region, Russian troops continued to assault Chasiv Yar, a strategic town that the Kremlin has been trying to occupy for months. Ukrainian troops partially withdrew from the town late last week. Military analysts say if Russia occupies Chasiv Yar, it would make it easier to take over other towns in the area. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
Officials in Texas are telling residents along the coast to be prepared for Tropical Storm Beryl, which is nearing landfall. The outer bands of the storm, which is expected to become a hurricane again as it moves over warm water, are expected to hit shore tomorrow with landfall on Monday. Beryl hit Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula yesterday. The storm has maximum sustained winds of 60 miles an hour. You're listening to NPR News. 100 life-size sculptures of Indian elephants are starting a cross-country journey in the U.S. this holiday weekend. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports the Great Elephant Migration Traveling Art Exhibit aims to spread awareness about conservation efforts.
Artisans in Tamil Nadu in southern India made the enormous lifelike elephant sculptures out of Lantana camara. That's the tough invasive weed that's been encroaching heavily upon the elephants' natural forest habitat, pushing them onto tea and coffee plantations where they coexist with humans. Tash Takekara is a wildlife conservationist connected with the project.
So it's almost trying to change the dominant conservation paradigm, to think of the world as a whole rather than this very binary separation of people and nature.
The sculptures can be seen in Newport, Rhode Island through early September. From there, they will head to New York City, Miami, the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana, and finally Los Angeles next summer. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Russia says 10 of its wrestlers who were offered spots at the Paris Olympics this month as neutrals won't compete. The Russian Wrestling Federation says coaches and athletes reached a unanimous decision to refuse. If they had participated, it would have been the biggest group of Russians in any one sport competing in Paris under the Individual Neutral Athlete Program, which allows some athletes from Russia and Belarus to compete during Russia's war in Ukraine. The IOC says 23 Russian athletes in 7 sports accepted invitations to the Olympics, including the wrestlers. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include ECMC Foundation, whose North Star is to eliminate equity gaps in post-secondary completion by 2040 so that underserved learners have greater opportunity for social and economic mobility.
From PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm your host, Jody Powell. I grew up with a mother, a sister, and a grandmother who were always, always on time. My grandmother especially. She showed up dressed to the nines and early. Also, she would say to me, life will make sense in good time. I, on the other hand, respect time, but let's just say the respect is not mutual. I'm always trying to balance my time correctly, or just plainly make sense of it. In this hour, stories of how time can change the way we understand life. Our first story comes from Otis Gray. Otis told this at our New Orleans Slam at Cafe Istanbul, where we partner with WWNO. Here's Otis.
In the summer of 2018, after 7 years of an incredible relationship, my girlfriend and I were at a crossroads with our differences. And a big one of those was kids. Grace never wanted kids. I always wanted kids, so that was a big one. But it wasn't the only one. We were also living in Brooklyn, where she wanted to live forever, and I was reluctant to move to in the first place. And she valued things like financial stability and, you know, being able to go out and do nice, classy New York things. And I was a sculptor turned radio producer. So, and I
I wanted to go one day without talking about the apocalypse. Like, that was her thing. And it was also a reason for her not having kids. I logged into her Amazon account by accident one day, and there was a flare gun, a map of the Hudson River, and a raft, which led to a really heated discussion about not if the rapture was nigh, but where, in our Brooklyn apartment, she thought we were going to put a goddamn raft. We loved each other very, very much. But it felt like we wanted things that we couldn't have together. And no matter how much we tried to change for each other, it just felt like we were fighting the inevitable and we were growing apart. But I'm very stubborn, and I could not see myself not growing old with this person. And I wanted to show her that I could maybe be the person that sometimes she wished I was. I thought that would be like the brave thing to do. So, as a grand gesture on her birthday with very limited funds, I decided I was going to take Grace to Carnegie Hall. The classic New York Humphrey Bogart Grace Kelly kind of night. I got the suit, I got the haircut, I found a concerto on her birthday. Yeah, it went to like Italian words and the word chorus. I'm like, that's what I want. And I called her and I'm like, hey, wear a red dress and meet me at the south entrance of Central Park. Falling in love with myself at this point. So the night comes, and we meet, and we look amazing. And she takes my arm, and I escort her up the stairs of the majestic Carnegie Hall to our box seats with the red velvet chairs and the booming architecture and looking at the stage that Pavarotti sang on. And I'm just crushing this so hard. Like, just, God. Soon as we sit down, something is off. First there's like a whole extended family in the balcony in front of us, and they turn and ask, oh, who are you here to see? Which is a weird thing to ask someone at a concert you are also at. But I'm like, okay, no, it's cool. And then the house lights go down, and the stage is lit, and this little girl walks on the stage, followed by another, and another, and another. So there's like 150 children on this stage, and we both know what's happening, and we don't want to say it, and they immediately break out into the most uncoordinated, nightmarish rendition of Scarborough Fair. And without looking, I can just hear Grace's jaw drop in utter amazement and disappointment. Like, this was so on brand for me to do. But then, like, this is all wrong. There's this Carnegie Hall. Why are these kids so sad? Why is the music so depressing? Why does that guy have, like, the flip-up sunglasses? And, like, some people in the crowd are crying and they're taking videos on their phone. And I realize, I have brought my struggling relationship to an elementary school chorus recital. Okay, but then the song ends, and this little girl walks up to the mic. She's got sequins. She's like, I'm Sandra. I'm like, okay, Sandra, we gotta turn this thing around. I got a lot riding on this show. She's like, this is an original song about the poison water in Flint, Michigan. Like, if Grace's reasons for not having kids were turned into a musical, this was it. And then the Flint song ends, and this dad at the other end of the theater just delivers the most perfectly executed snore that reverberates through the silence of Carnegie Hall. And for the first time, we look at each other dead in the eyes with just tears running down our face, trying not to break out of the most offensive laughter. And then that look was everything we had to say. Like, this is the worst thing ever. This is the best thing ever. You're a total train wreck. You're a crazy person. I love you. I love you too so much. Are we breaking up? Yeah, I think so. Finally, intermission hits, and we sprint through the lobby and collapse outside in front of a bunch of parents on a smoke break and laugh at their children harder than we have laughed at anything in our entire lives. And 2 weeks later, we decide to break up, which was the hardest, saddest thing either of us had ever done besides sitting through half of that concert. And what I know now is
the brave thing to do is not to always just relentlessly try to make something the way that you thought it would be, but to know when to walk away from something, especially if you love it, and no matter how much it hurts. Grace and I are still really good friends, and I joke, that's how we're going to grow old together. And she's like, probably not. Statistically, with food shortages, it's just... But she promised that when the world does come to an end, I have a spot in her raft, as long as I promise to never, ever take her back to Carnegie Hall. Thank you.
That was Otis Gray. Otis is a radio producer from the woods of Belmont, Vermont. He currently lives in Brooklyn, making stories about people and food, and is the host of a podcast called Sleepy, where he reads old books to help people sleep. 6 years later, Grace and Otis are still best friends, and neither of them has been back to Carnegie Hall. We are also happy to report that Otis is living a new love story. Our next storyteller, Raina Bowles, told the story at the Moth's 2023 Education Showcase at Culture Lab in Long Island City. Here's Raina.
So I never thought I'd see the day my sister would go. Me and my sister Brenda did everything together. We wore the same clothes sometimes. We liked to coordinate. It was the same, like, blue jean shorts and purple shirt because purple was her favorite color. And our favorite show to watch was SpongeBob. It was just something about the way SpongeBob and Patrick were best friends. And it reminded us of how me and Brenda were sisters by chance, but always friends by choice. We loved each other so, so much. People would often say me and Brenda were tied by the hip because of so much of the time we spent together. And I mean, I didn't disagree with that. But people would also tell me, you know, Raina, one day Brenda's going to leave you because she was 2 years older than me. And at the time, I really didn't care what they said because there was never a time where Brenda did leave me. So I really undermined what they said and, you know, kept it going because my sister would never go anywhere. And so at the age of 7, I remember watching this basketball game, and it was a women's basketball game, college basketball, and it, like, resonated with me so much. It was something about the way they were, like, so strong and fierce and how they played the game that made me want to play. And so next thing I know, I'm telling my parents, I think I want to play basketball. And so that's what I did. And because me and Brenda did everything together, she began playing basketball. And that kind of became our thing. We practiced all the time. We went outside. That's what we would do. We loved basketball. But we never played on the same team because, like I said, Brenda was always 2 years older than me. And, you know, it was okay because we got to practice together. But when I hit my freshman year of high school, Brenda was a junior. And luckily, we went to the same school, so we got to play on the same basketball team. And when I say the first season I've ever played with my sister was the best season of my life, I mean it. I've played many, many basketball games from the age of 7, and I lost many basketball games, won many basketball games, but with her, win or lose, it was just so amazing. And so everyone would congratulate us because that happened to be one of our best seasons in our school when me and Brenda played together. And next year, after that, I was a sophomore and Brenda was a senior. And as soon as the season started, everyone would ask me, Raina, how does it feel that Brenda's going to leave you for college? And I was just confused. I was like, what do you mean? Like, she's not going anywhere. Because, you know, once again, I never, ever had a moment where Brenda would leave me. It was just, that never occurred to me that that would happen. And so when they said it, I kind of felt angry. I was like, why would you ever say that to me? You know, I kind of just thought they were jealous or they were just making it up because she couldn't leave me, you know? And so the year goes by, and we play another spectacular basketball season, and everyone's congratulating us, and we make it to our first playoff game. And it was a very, very interesting game, and we ended up winning by 3 points. And, you know, it was a beautiful thing. Our team was so happy, and that was another game I got to play with Brenda. And so our second basketball game playoff basketball game, Brenda woke up that morning and she was like, Raina, it's okay if we don't play another basketball game. I just want you to know, like, playing basketball was something that I will always cherish and I will never, ever forget this time with you. And I looked at her and I'm like, what is she talking about? Like, she's not going anywhere. Why is she making this such a sentimental thing? And so I go to school with the same attitude, you know, thinking Brenda's not going anywhere. And people are coming up to me saying, Raina, like, how does it feel Brenda's leaving? And like, I'm like so irritated because I'm like, why do they keep coming up to me saying the same thing and nothing's going to happen? You know, Brenda is not going anywhere. And so we get to the lunchroom, ready to depart the school to go to our game. And there Brenda comes up to me again and she's like giving me another big hug. And she's like, Raina, I want you to know, win or lose, like, I really, really appreciated this time with you. I'll never forget, no matter how far I go. And I'm like, Brenda, you're not going anywhere. Like, why is this a thing? Like, why are people telling me she's leaving? Like, this is crazy. And so we get to the game, and we get to the gym, and the stakes are already high as soon as we get there. The crowd is full. And there are people looking at us, already trash-talking us, you know, because we had lost 5 games, and they were undefeated. So, you know, we were kind of intimidated, and they were, like, not intimidated at all. They thought they were... And so, warming up, I see, like, the mood is just different on my team. And we had a very, like, spectacular team that year. It was, our chemistry was right on. We played as a team, always. And so when I saw the mood was different, I was like, you know, something's off, like... Everybody's smile is a little different. The way they're talking is a little different. The way we're warming up is a little different. And that's when it occurred to me that this was going to be Brenda's last game if we lost. And so I stood there in the layup line just looking, and I was completely quiet. And I was just looking at Brenda smiling and looking at her enjoying herself. And that's also when I realized, like, this had to be the game where I had to, like, really shed blood, sweat, and tears for my sister. Because if we lost this game, I'd be losing Brenda. She'd be going off to college before I knew it, and that would be the end for us. And so the game starts, and there's pushing, there's shoving, there's yelling. There might have even been a little trash talking, not from me, though. And, you know, everybody's really playing their hardest game. And the other team thought this was going to be an easy game, considering we lost a fair share of games. But it wasn't. And by the time there are 30 seconds left in this game, we're up by 3. And I'm like, yes. And my chest is hurting. My heart is beating. And I'm like, we won this game. And Brenda gets to stay another game. I get to play another game with my sister. And I'm so overjoyed. And I'm running around. And we're all smiling. We're cheering. And then all of a sudden, I look at the clockboard again. And we're down by 3. There's 15 seconds left in the game. And I'm like, we have to win. Like, I have no choice. If we lose this game, I lose Brenda. I cannot let that happen. And so I go in for a layup, and I get fouled. And the thing about me is I don't work well under pressure at all. And like I said, you know, the crowd was full. There's people yelling. They're like, you're going to miss. And I'm like, maybe I will, but, you know, I'm not going to show you that. And so I get to the foul line, and I turn around. I see Brenda. She's like, Raina, you got this. Take a deep breath. You can do it. I look at the bench where my coach and my team is, and they're like, Raina, you got it. Just take a deep breath. And so the ref passes me the ball. I take a deep breath. I look at the big red numbers, the big red 15 on the time clock, and I look at the big red rim, and I look up, and I'm like, I can do it. My hands are sweating. My heart is beating. I take a deep breath, like everyone said, and I shoot, and I miss. And I was like, how did I do that? You know, like, everything is on the line here. How could I possibly have missed this foul shot for my sister? But I didn't give up. I was like, maybe if I make the second one, somebody on my team can make a layup, they can shoot, and we could win. Maybe it could be a tie. Maybe it could be a draw. Maybe we go into overtime. I'm thinking of all the possibilities that I could have another game with my sister. And so when I get the ball for the second time, I'm like, this is the second chance that I have to make sure me and Brenda have another game to play. So I take that deep breath, and I close my eyes. I open them. I look at the rim. I look at the big red numbers. I look at Brenda. I dribble once, and I shoot, and I miss. And then I look at my team, and everyone's scrambling for the rebound, and I'm like, I have to get in there too, so I try to keep going, and I try to keep playing, but before I know it, time is out. I hear the buzzer beater. The other team is cheering, and my team is just like, it's okay. Like, they're happy for the run that we had. And Brenda runs up to me, and she's like, Raina, you played great. And I'm like, how could she say that to me when I missed our only chance to play together again? And in that moment, I was like, I lost her. I lost the game, and I lost Brenda. And that was hard. And then, you know, at the end of that year, Brenda went off to college. She ended up going to Cornell, which is really good. And the other day I went to go see her, and one of the first things we did was play basketball. And it was with that same smile that she had, the same fierceness. You know, we never end a game because there's always arguments, and that's a foul, and you miss. But we always love playing together, and that's what we did. And the same feeling that I had when I played with her on the court for our last game was the same feeling I had when I played with her at the court of Cornell. And that's when I realized that no amount of distance could ever take away the friendship that me and my sister have. Thank you.
That was Raina Bowles. Raina is currently a senior in high school. We met Raina when she joined the Moth team at Eastside Community High School. Raina enjoys going on long walks with her dogs, playing basketball, and trying new foods. And note that Raina's sister Brenda Bowles in the story is also a Moth Education alumni and former teaching intern. To see a photo of her and her sister on the court, head over to themoth.org. After the break, a young woman in Bangalore, India, is running out of time to decide who her arranged marriage partner will be. That's when the Moth Radio Hour continues. Support for the Moth comes from Odoo. Odoo is an all-in-one business management platform designed to handle the unique needs of any company. More information at odoo.com/moth. That's odoo.com/moth.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, prx.org.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and we're always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for the Moth Radio Hour here on a Saturday evening. Drop in at Kansas City's Green Lady Lounge any late night, and you're apt to see the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. They're in the spotlight on tonight's Live at Green Lady Lounge. Join us for an hour of Kansas City jazz. Live at Green Lady Lounge is this evening at 6 o'clock here on Kansas Public Radio. And tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, a slight chance of showers overnight, partly cloudy, a low of 67. 60% chance of showers and thunderstorms for Sunday, partly sunny with a high of 82. 60% chance of showers and thunderstorms Sunday night, cloudy with lows in the mid-60s. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jody Powell. In this hour, we are listening to stories about time. And next up, Anu Sainan is running out of time and has to make a decision whether she likes it or not. Anu told this at a New York City Grand Slam at the Music Hall of Williamsburg, where WNYC is a media partner of the Moth. Here's Anu.
I was 21 when my dad started to look for a suitable boy for me. I was living in Bangalore, India at the time, and arranged marriages were pretty common in our family. It meant that not just the boy and the girl had to like each other, but the families also had to like each other. 4 years on, by the time I'm 25, I've met 14 boys. That's equal to 14 failed matches. Boy number one was very quiet and shy. I, obviously, loud and chatty. Never heard back from him. Boy number six was more into my high school grades than he was into me. I said no. Boy number 12, his profile seemed very interesting, but our horoscopes didn't match. The astrologer said the marriage would end in disaster, so the family said no. And all the other guys I saw, they thought I wasn't good enough. It was like they were shopping for a wife and I didn't fit the bill. Now by this point, my father is very desperate. He thinks I'll end up single for the rest of my life and it freaks him out. Now when he gets desperate, I feel the pressure to commit to a marriage very quickly. And that freaks me out. Because honestly, I don't know what a happy marriage looks like. My parents have had an arranged marriage, but theirs is a love-hate relationship that borders mostly on hate. As a child, I once seen them get into a terrible argument, and my mom ended up with a black eye. And that image is stuck in my head as I wonder if that would be my future. Seeing how conflicted I am, my best friend gives me a book. It's called The Secret. Now, you may have heard of it. It talks of how to manifest what you want in life. And it has a chapter on attracting the partner of your dreams. It talks of doing all kinds of fun stuff like sleeping on one side of your bed to create the physical space in your life for this person to come in. But my favorite is to create a list of all the qualities that you need in your partner. Now, this is easy. All I have to do is look to my parents' marriage and then decide what I don't want. My partner has to be loving. He has to be respectful. He has to be funny, because it's sexy. He has to be mature and confident, you know, not insecure or jealous around my friends, especially the men. And he has to be understanding. That's it. Now that weekend, Dad and I are going to meet boy number 15 in a coffee shop. One look at this guy, and I make a note to update my list. Now I'm short, but he's shorter. He's also very nervous, and I'm not exactly warm. So coffee ends quickly, and as he leaves the coffee shop, my dad and I, we get into a massive argument. My father thinks I should marry him because he's good enough. I said, no way, he's too short. My father takes offense because he's 5'4". And he storms out of the coffee shop. I end up in tears and go to my best friend, because this is not the right guy for me. But my father doesn't seem to understand. So what do? My friend, she comes up with a very practical solution. She pulls out a coin from her purse, and she asks me to toss it. Heads, my family wins, I marry the boy. Tails, I win, I say no. Now I'm 25, tired of this matchmaking charade, and very keen to get my dad off my back. So I agreed to her plan. And I toss. It lands heads. We look at each other, and then I pick up the phone and call my mom. And I say it's a yes. Now my mom is my biggest supporter. She really wants to see me happy, but she just let out a sigh of relief. Everyone's getting tired. That night, I cannot sleep because I've just gambled with my life and agreed to marry someone I don't know or even like. What am I doing? The next morning, my mom calls me back. Apparently, the boy said no. I'm telling you, rejection has never felt so good. Life goes on. A few months later, early December, my mom calls me back. Boy number 16 and his family are coming to our parents' house. So I go over, and as I walk into my parents' living room, I'm greeted by the boy's mom, aunt, uncle, the whole family is there. And then I turn to the boy, and he gives me a smile. It's very kind. And I smile back at him, and in that moment, I felt a connect. The family asked me a few questions, and then they leave the room to give us the space to talk. His name is Deepu, and he works in Delhi, in a different city. And he asked me if I can get a transfer from my office to Delhi. I say yes. In my head, that question translates to, do you like me? When they leave, I tell my mom, it's a yes. The next day, Deepu's mom calls to say it's a yes. So we start chatting. And the next week, he surprises me by showing up in Bangalore with a teddy bear and a box of chocolates. I don't like teddy bears. But I love chocolates. We hang out the whole day, and in the evening, I take him bowling to meet my friends. And he hits it off with them. And by the end of the night, he has me laughing so hard, I stop to think. I can't remember the last time I felt so good. And that list seems to be coming true. Before I know it, I'm in love. And 6 months on, we get married in front of friends and family. Today, we have a 12-year-old son. And there's one thing he definitely doesn't know. And that's what an unhappy marriage looks like. Thank you.
Anu Sainan is the host of the podcast Heroes of New York that she started during the pandemic to tell stories of everyday heroes. She is a two-time Moth Story Slam winner and an avid camper, kayaker, and traveler. Anu wants us to know that she still has the same husband. She has never done the coin flip again, but has applied the law of attraction several times to manifest the job she desired, to move to New York City, and to win the Moth Slam. To see photos of Anu and her family, head over to themoth.org. Do you have a story of you racing against time or trying to make meaning of it? You can pitch us by recording it right on our site or call 877-799-MOTH. That's 877-799-6684. The best pitches are developed for Moth shows all around the world. Here's a pitch from Christine Deng.
I grew up in the hustle and bustle of Chinatown. My mom worked as a nurse in the neighborhood just a few streets away from where I attended elementary school. The two of us often took the F train together, me to kindergarten and my mom to the hospital. I was 4 when I started taking the subway with my mom, but I knew the stops by heart even before I was able to spell them. When I turned 6, I felt confident enough to navigate the subway without needing to hold my mom's hand. In between transfers, I started walking in front of her, pretending that I was going to school alone, like all the other teenagers I saw. That all changed, though, a few weeks later. During one of our typical morning commutes, when I saw an Express D train roll into the station. In an attempt to minimize our commute time, I immediately bolted off the F train we were on. Surprised, my mom quickly ran after me, only for the subway doors to automatically close with her still inside. I turned around shocked with the realization that I had left the train without her. As her subway car slowly moved away, she mouthed, "Get off at the next stop." I nodded, holding back my tears, and immediately boarded the D train to meet her. Although my subway ride was brief, it was the first time I had ever taken it by myself. Suddenly, I missed the feeling of my mom's fingers interlocked with mine. As my train rolled into the following stop, I frantically scanned the station for my mom. When my eyes landed on a familiar frame, I shouted, "Ma!" Her head immediately turned toward me. We ran to each other, ignoring all of the anxious onlookers. She hugged me and whispered, "My baby, you did it. I am so glad you are safe."
Remember, you can pitch us at 877-799-MOTH or online at themoth.org, where you can also share these stories or others from the Moth Archive. In a moment, a storyteller takes us down a hallway and up the stairwell to a room only a few know exists. That's when the Moth Radio Hour continues. This show
show is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive Insurance. Snapshot from Progressive gives a personalized rate based on actual driving habits. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Snapshot is not available in California or from all agents.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 89.7 Emporia, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for the Moth Radio Hour here on a Saturday evening. This week on KPR Presents, from Martha Washington to Dr. Jill Biden, the changing role of First Lady. Diana Carlin is the author of not one but two new books about the office of First Lady. She joins Kay McIntyre for KPR Presents, 6 o'clock tomorrow evening, here on Kansas Public Radio. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, partly cloudy skies, a slight chance of showers overnight, and a low of 67. Showers and thunderstorms likely for Sunday, 60% chance of rain, a high of 82. 60% chance of showers Sunday night with lows in the mid-60s. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jody Powell. In this episode, we've been listening to stories all about time. Final story comes from Vivian Yoon. Vivian told this at our main stage in San Francisco at the Herbst Theater. Here's Vivian.
I grew up across the street from my high school. Every morning, I would bow goodbye to my grandma on the porch, and I would walk across the street to school. And she would stand there in her orange and cream pajamas and watch me while I went. And even though I could feel her eyes on me the entire time, I never turned around because I was too busy thinking the same thing over and over again. How did I get here? So ever since I was a little kid, my grandma, she would tell everyone she knew that I was so smart, I was like a little genius. She would constantly bring up the fact that I started reading at the age of 2, or how as a toddler I would just strike up conversations with strangers. My parents didn't think that these two things made me a genius, but they did want me to be smart. And my dad, he would do this thing where he would quiz me using these trivia cards for kids. And the stakes with these cards were so high. Because every time I got a question wrong, it was devastating, right? Like it was somehow proof that I wasn't a genius after all. But when I got a question right, it was the best feeling in the world. Because I could see the pride in my dad's face. And all I wanted to do was chase that feeling of him seeing me and seeing what I could do. But then my parents split up, and there were no more afternoons with the cards. I was now living with my dad and my grandma. My dad was busy with work. I barely saw my mom. And my grandma, she mostly stayed in her room where she watched Korean dramas and American baseball. And anytime she would come out of her room to where I was, she would always say the same thing to me in Korean. 공부 열심히 해야 돼. You have to study hard. She wanted me to get into a good school and get a good job and make lots of money, which, you know, it's fine and kind of expected for a Korean grandmother, but it was also something she said to me every single time she saw me, which was multiple times a day, every day. And eventually it got to be so suffocating, right? Like the pressure was too much and I started to feel like I couldn't even breathe without her telling me to study. So I started to avoid her. Eventually she caught on and we saw each other less. And things got pretty lonely in that house. My parents would sometimes forget my birthdays and I was usually in charge of making dinner for myself. My specialty was Chef Boyardee ravioli, mini, not regular. I had taste. And I watched a lot of TV. And my favorite shows at the time were these old sitcoms from the 80s and 90s, like Family Ties and Growing Pains, you know? Shows about happy families doing stuff together. And I idolized the teens in these stories, and I couldn't wait to go to high school and do all the classic American things they did, like walk across a grassy quad while holding your textbooks, or go to football games with friends, or stress out about who is taking who to prom. But when it came time for me to go to high school, my parents decided that it would be best for everyone if I went to the school across the street from my dad's house, an inner city high school that didn't have any of those classic American things I wanted. There was no grassy quad. The entire school was concrete and asphalt and chain link fence. And I didn't even think about going to football games or prom with friends because I didn't have any friends. At this school, I was just one faceless kid in a sea of thousands. And I felt completely invisible. And then one day, I was sitting in my biology class. You know, everyone's doing that thing where you take turns reading from the textbook. It's my turn. I start reading. And when I finish, I realize the entire class has gone silent. And the teacher is staring at me. And he writes me this note, and he hands it to me, and he says, "Take this to the fourth floor." Which is confusing, because this building only has 3 floors. But I do what he says. I go up the main steps, I go to the third floor, I turn right, and I see this plain, unmarked door that I've never noticed before. And I open the door, and I see this narrow stairwell leading up. And there are these giant, colorful dinosaur murals on both sides, and there's this security camera blinking down at me. And I get to the top of the steps, and I push the door open, and I step out onto the roof. And the only thing around are these 2 big blue double doors. And when I push them open, I see this giant classroom. It's got like floor-to-ceiling bookshelves lining the walls, and there's like natural light streaming in through the windows, and it looks nothing like the rest of the school below. And there are all these kids just walking around, hanging out. Like, one group of kids is looking at this anatomical skeleton in the corner, and there's another group over here discussing Eastern European politics, and then I hear one kid say the phrase, "amorphous blob," and it hits me. This is where the nerds are. So the fourth floor, as we all called it, it quickly becomes my home, and I find out that the teacher here, Mr. Holland, he coaches something called academic decathlon. Decathlon, it's this yearly competition where schools all over the country compete in a series of 10 subjects, you know, literature, art, math, science, etc. But there's one subject that's different, Super Quiz. Because Super Quiz is a live event held in front of an audience. And it turns out our school is actually pretty good at Super Quiz. And the decathlon kids are like royalty on the fourth floor, okay? They get these like custom blue and white Letterman jackets with their names stitched on them. And they get all these perks like free pizza on Fridays. And everybody knows who the team members are. So when Mr. Holland asked me my sophomore year if I want to join, I'm like, hell yeah. Because remember, I'm like starving for attention at home. So the fact that this adult sees something in me and wants to invite me to join this like super exclusive group of kids that get special treatment, I'm so in. So I join the team. We study all year. It's finally competition time. The first 2 days of the competition go by in a blur, right? It's just a bunch of kids taking a bunch of tests in these big rooms. And in our downtime, our team scopes out the number one seed that year, Taft High. And everybody on my team is super intimidated by the team captain at Taft because there are all these rumors about him, right? Like how he's getting a full ride to Stanford and how he got a perfect score on his SATs and how his family doesn't even own a microwave because his mom cooks home-cooked meals every night using the oven. So yeah, he's scary. But me, I am more intimidated by the second in command at Taft because I have seen this kid wearing purple Uggs. And in my mind, you cannot be the kind of kid that wears purple Uggs unless you have the most loving and supportive parents who encourage you to do things like express yourself. And every time I see this kid in his purple Uggs, my mind instantly flashes to his home life. And I just picture his mom picking him up from school and saying, "How was your day, honey?" as she makes him ants on a log and PB&Js, but not too many snacks because dinner's already on the stove. And I compare that to my own life, where I come home after school to an empty house and eat canned food in front of the TV. And as I think about that difference between our two worlds, I feel myself disappearing. Like that picture in Back to the Future, I just feel myself fading until I'm not there anymore. We get to the morning of Super Quiz. I put on my blue and white Letterman jacket and I catch a ride to the venue with my friend because my parents are busy. And when we get there, our coach leads us into this back room where all the teams are waiting for the event to start. You know, everybody's like talking, we're all nervous, except for Purple Ugg guy, he's totally fine. And suddenly we hear music and the announcer, and we realize the opening ceremonies have started. And one by one, all the teams start walking into the auditorium, holding their school signs, and they start walking the floor. Finally, it's our turn. I step inside, and I see all these people in the bleachers cheering. And there are these student desks lining the floor in threes like little canoes. Our team finds our spot on the sidelines, and the competition begins. I walk up to one of the desks. I sit down. The proctor reads the first question out loud. And I realize I know the answer. So I bubble it in furiously. Time runs out. The proctor announces the correct answer. And I take my pencil and I wave it around my head to show my teammates that I got it right. And the crowd erupts. And it feels like all of that applause is just for me. And it's the best feeling, like getting those trivia questions right with my dad, but times a thousand, because all these people are seeing me and seeing what I can do. There are 9 more questions, and I wave my pencil 9 more times. And at the end, I stand on stage with my teammates as the announcer declares us first place. So our teammates, you know, we are all hugging and cheering and high-fiving. And then slowly they all start to walk away to join their families who had come to see them. But I just hang back with my coach because no one had come to see me. And I look around and I see Purple Ugg guy with his family. I'm right, they totally love him. And even though his team didn't win, I see his mom say to him, "I am so proud of you." And when I get home, my dad's out. My grandma's waiting by the door. She wants to know how it went. I show her my medals and I tell her we won, and she wants to know more, but I tell her I'm tired. And I go into my room and I cry myself to sleep. The next Monday, we all show up to school. Everyone's excited. You know, we're making big plans for next year, how it's going to be even better. But then our coach walks in and he says he got an offer to coach the decathlon team at a different school, at a better school, and he's not coming back next year. And he leaves. And the rest of high school, for me, it's like a haze, right? Without decathlon, without my coach, I go back to feeling invisible. I hang out with, you know, the wrong crowd. I start ditching school. I barely graduate. And I don't even go to my own graduation because I'm not sure that anyone from my family will come. And then a few weeks later, I pack my things and I move out. And as the years go by, I still visit my grandma from time to time. But I keep the visits short because that house just holds so many difficult memories. And then one day I'm at home and I'm looking through this box of old photos, And I see a picture of me with my old decathlon teammates, and we're, you know, wearing our Letterman jackets, and we're cheesing for the camera, and I start to wonder, whatever happened to my jacket and those medals? So the next time I visit my grandma, I ask her, do you know what happened to my things from decathlon? And she says, yeah, and she leads me down the hallway, and she opens the door to her bedroom, and I'm hit with that familiar smell of old books and mothballs, and I see all the furniture is the same since I was a kid. The old wooden dresser and vanity, the little nightstand where she kept her radio and her newspaper, the tiny silver TV she used to watch Korean dramas and American baseball. And then she points behind me, and I turn around, and I see all of my medals pinned in a row. And hanging up next to them, my blue and white Letterman jacket with my name stitched on them. And I realize this spot on the wall is directly across from her bed, which means she has been staring at these every day for the last 10 years. And I turn to her and I say, 이걸 다 갖고 계셨어요? You kept these all this time? And she says, 그럼, of course. And in that moment, all these memories just come flooding back, and I picture her standing there on the porch, watching me walk to school, hoping that just once I would turn around and look at her. And I think about that day after the competition, when I came home with all my medals, and I could tell how badly she wanted to know what happened and how much she wished that she could have been there. And I think about how I had never even thought to invite her. And I imagine her standing in that empty house after I had left, collecting those medals and carefully pinning them up one by one. Because even after all that time and all that distance between us, she was still so, so proud of her smart granddaughter, of her little genius. Growing up, all I wanted was for someone to see me. It turns out someone had. I just hadn't seen her. Thank you.
Vivian Yoon is a Korean-American writer and performer from Koreatown, Los Angeles. She recently wrote and hosted the award-winning podcast, K-Pop Dreaming. The series blends memoir, oral history, and pop culture analysis to explore Korean culture through music. Vivian said she went back to LA High a few years ago, and the fourth floor no longer exists. Turns out the place closed down shortly after that decathlon coach left the school. Current teachers she spoke with had no idea it had even been a thing. You can share these stories or others from the Moth Archive and buy tickets to Moth storytelling events in your area through our website, themoth.org. There are Moth events year-round. Find a show near you and come out and tell a story. You can find us on Facebook and X at The Moth and on Instagram and TikTok at Moth Stories. And that's it for this episode of The Moth Radio Hour. Thank you to our storytellers for sharing with us and to you for listening. I hope you'll join us next time.
This episode of the Moth Radio Hour was produced by me, Jay Allison, and Jody Powell, who also hosted and directed the stories in the show. Co-producer is Vicky Merrick, associate producer Emily Couch. Additional education program instruction by Amy Blumberg and Eric Carrera. The rest of the Malsa leadership team includes Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin Janess, Jennifer Hickson, Meg Bowles, Kate Tellers, Marina Kluche, Leanne Gully, Suzanne Rust, Brandon Grant, Sarah Jane Johnson, and Aldi Kaza. The Moth Education Program is made possible by generous support from unlikely collaborators. Additional program support is provided by the New York State Council on the Arts, the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs, Alice Gottesman, the Cornelia T. Bailey Foundation, and Con Edison. Most stories are true as remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Stellwagen Symphonette, Antonio Vivaldi, Phil Cook, Little Bang, and Espa. We receive funding from the National Endowment for the Arts. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching us your own story, which we always hope you will, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3, and QChanute, FM 90.3. Online at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. Thanks for joining us here on a Saturday evening. Stay tuned for Live at Green Lady Lounge, and then at 7, Daryl Brogdon is your host for the Retro Cocktail Hour. Slight chance of showers and thunderstorms overnight tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, a low of 67. 60% chance of showers and thunderstorms for tomorrow, a high of 82. Showers and thunderstorms likely Sunday night. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
Jazz can be enjoyed anywhere, but there's nothing like hearing it performed live. And a great jazz venue provides the perfect atmosphere, whether it's the decor, the menu, or the ghosts of jazz past. Right now, we're at the Green Lady Lounge, located at 1809 Grand Boulevard in the heart of Kansas City. I'm David Bassey. Welcome to Live at Green Lady Lounge. The Reyes Brothers Organ Trio are familiar faces here at the Green Lady, with Andre Reyes Jr. at the Hammond B3 organ, Antonio Reyes at the drums, and guitarist Taylor Smith. You can hear them just about every week, so let's do that. The Reyes Brothers Organ Trio, live at Green Lady Lounge. Thank you.
We'll be right back. Thank you so much, and welcome out to the Green Lady Lounge tonight, y'all. We are the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. On guitar, give it up for Mr. Taylor Smith on the guitar. On the drums, our brother, Mr. Antonio Reyes. And my name is Andre Reyes Jr., and we are the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. Thank you all so much for coming out to the Green Lady Lounge. We'll be here until 2:30 a.m., y'all. Sit back, relax, and enjoy your night with us. We are the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. Taylor Smith. Drunk.